evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, November 8, 2018. A South Sudanese civil society activist says his country is not ready for elections.
According to the agreement, we will have to write a new constitution, we'll have to write a new elections act, and then the environment, the security environment, the political environment, the economic and social environments do not actually at the moment present a good opportunity for South Sudan to hold elections.
And motorists with tinted car windows are back on the streets of Juba Town.
We advise the driver, we advise the owner of the car, we advise the rider that please don't repeat this and so on. So these slight violations, they sometimes even if that you are charged with fine, it will be very little amount.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A South Sudanese activist who just participated in monitoring the just-concluded U.S. midterm elections say South Sudan is not prepared to hold a credible and fair elections anytime soon. Rajab Mohandi says South Sudan needs new electoral laws and a constitution before any elections are held. He says his trip to the United States has taught him valuable lessons about the importance of free and fair elections.
It's a professional program, so it is designed to suit the professional backgrounds of different citizens from different countries. And so the particular program we are on is referred to generally as the International Visitors Leadership Program, and it focuses on elections. So I am from the civil society, and we have people from other countries, from elections commissions, and other public institutions, and our focus is the elections, the midterm elections.
How many of you are on this program currently?
Well, broadly, this international visitor leadership program brings close to 500 visitors to the United States every year. But on the elections component, we are about 48 from the different countries.
Yeah, talk to us about your experience visiting a polling station here in the United States. You also was involved in monitoring the recent elections in Zimbabwe. Could you give us some contrast between these two countries?
The program is broader than just monitoring elections, observing elections at a polling station. We started with visiting elections officials in Washington, D.C., and also in Kansas City and different other parts of the country. I personally visited an elections polling station and interacted with polling staff and watched people voting. There are a lot of differences in these processes, especially between the elections I observed in Zimbabwe and elections here in the United States. In Zimbabwe or in Africa, you'll find lots of police at the polling stations, and the process is manual with lots of observers, domestic and international. But here, the polling stations are completely free of police presence. You don't even find observers, domestic or international. It's mainly the polling officials running the process. The process is also computerized, so they use their cards to simply identify the voters and provide them polling materials, and they go and vote. And it's a very simple process, but it is safe, and safe of malpractices, and also the environment itself is just free of any interference of security, unlike the way it happens in our countries in Africa, where sometimes you find police, security, and so on filling up the polling stations.
This peace agreement that was negotiated in Khartoum and Addis Ababa stipulates that there will be elections at the end of the transitional period in South Sudan. Is South Sudan ready for an election based on your experiences from these two countries?
First, if I can get back to where we observed elections with the African Union in Zimbabwe, the election process in Zimbabwe was very credible, and the officials were very much qualified in the way they managed the elections, and it's the same case with the United States. They are following elections laws that are well established and understood by the elections officials. And of course, the elections are taking place in an environment of peace and security. But when you get back to South Sudan at the moment, this is not the case. First of all, according to the agreement, we will have to write a new constitution. We'll have to write a new elections act. And then the environment, the security environment, the political environment, the economic and social environments do not actually at the moment present a good opportunity for South Sudan to hold elections. And so there is a lot to be done between now and the end of the transition period to prepare the country for elections. So South Sudan has a long way to go and a lot to do between now and the end of the transition period when elections will be conducted.
What are you going to do with this knowledge that you are gaining here, given your focus on the issues of South Sudan? Are you going to sit with this knowledge? What are you going to do with it?
I am a civil society leader, and I have been very much involved in the peace process. And so the implementation of the peace agreement will require our participation. That is one advantage we have as people of South Sudan. And in that regard, I will be able to contribute, especially to the process of writing the elections laws, even writing the constitution, because it has a lot of elements on elections. And that will be my first aspect that I see as quite important in sharing the knowledge from these different countries where I've been observing elections.
That's Rajab Mohandis, the Chief Executive Officer at the Organization for Responsive Governance. He was speaking with me from Kansas, Missouri, earlier today. Residents of Yei Town say they want the new transitional government expected to be formed next year to deliver services to citizens. Vice President James Waniga was in Yei to promote the revitalized peace deal. Iga says the Kiir administration is trying to restore peace and stability so that people can receive health care and education. Daniel Friday-Martin has more for VOA from Yei Town.
Yei residents say if the government in Juba is to regain its image, it must end corruption and provide services to its citizens at the grassroots level. Yei resident Tabani Njidio says he particularly wants to see the government reform the security and employment sectors.
The army or the security sector should reflect the image of the country. That is to say, it should be balanced so that the people will have confidence in the security. For us to have a good government, to promote good governance, we must have the right people employed in the right place.
Yei resident Victoria Amani says since the signing of the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in 2005, the government provided less services to the civil population in the Yei area.
Since the signing of the CPA in 2005, we have been depending on help from non-governmental organizations, whether being education, water or health care. We want the government to do some work for its people so that we know that some services were provided by the government.
Another Yei Town resident who identifies himself only as Moses also demands that the government deliver basic services and pay soldiers on time.
The government has done too little for us. Most of the schools, hospitals, and the roads have been improved by the NGOs. We want the coming government to do its job. We also expect that the government to pay the soldiers on time so that issues to do with the rape and the mistreatment done by the soldiers will come to an end.
Another resident who prefers to identify himself only as Dixon says he expects the government to protect freedom of expression and movement.
What we are expecting is freedom of movement and the freedom of expression. Without any restriction, the security should be maintained so that the journalists should be in position even to take what measures they want to do. More especially those people in the rural area, they are suffering also. So we need the government also to open the road so that those people will get the services.
Addressing thousands of Yei residents during a public rally at Yei Freedom Square to promote the revised peace deal, Vice President James Waniga said the Juba government is committed to implementing the revitalized agreement. Speaking in Arabic, Iga said the government will pave key roads to boost trade along the South Sudan, Uganda, and Congo border areas.
The road networks from Yei Kaya, Yei Maridi, and Rumbek has been put into plan, and the Chinese company will tarmac these roads here. The Chinese company said they will only come to Yei once there is peace
and instability. So let's stop the killings and instability so that development and trade can come here.
Iga says the government hopes to increase oil production by the end of the year to raise revenues so the government can increase the delivery of services to its citizens. Daniel Friday Martin, VOA News, Yetown.
The South Sudan government has reversed an earlier order banning vehicles with tinted windows on the streets of Juba Town. The government has announced that such vehicles are no longer illegal on the road after a public outcry from drivers whose vehicles were impounded. Winnie Chirino has the story for VOA from Juba.
One border operator stationed in Juba's High Mauna neighborhood, who spoke on condition of anonymity for fear of reprisal from authorities, accuses traffic police of extorting money from border drivers even when they have obtained all the necessary documents to operate their motorcycle.
If they tell you pay 2,000, you pay. If they tell you pay how much money, you pay. If you don't pay, they took there your motorcycle. And when they took there, even if you have everything, logbook, everything, they don't release you, your motorbike just like that. They will still charge you on this.
Another cyclist stationed in Juba's Kololo neighborhood who declined to be identified for fear of reprisals says the traffic police often bar border drivers from using a main street from Juba's Buluk area to Muduria, commonly known as Jowan Road. He says the traffic police always force cyclists to take longer routes, forcing them to increase their fees.
Any police or an army man can decide to arrest a motorbike, eh? Just within the area, even on the road, not even a traffic police. They just arrest people, like they call for money, and they are given money, of course. Of course, somebody will pay the money because for the sake of his motorbike.
Speaking in Arabic, another motorcycle taxi operator stationed in Tongping residential area accuses the Juba City Council Border Association of collecting 500 South Sudanese pounds for monthly subscription, and yet the association does nothing to support cyclists when after they have submitted complaints of theft, attacks and harassments by police soldiers.
They are
supposed to help us when we have problems. I am among the few people whose motorbike was stolen and I was attacked. My motorbike was taken and I went to the office to report and I gave them their registration form together with a photocopy of my logbook. They told me they will see a way forward to look for it. My paper has been there almost 1 month. There is nothing.
Major General Daniel Justin, spokesperson of the South Sudan National Police Service, says motorcyclists and other drivers must obey all road regulations and advises drivers to request a receipt if fined.
There are violations which we consider as minor violations. This is where we advise the driver, we advise the owner of the car, we advise the rider that please don't repeat this and so on. So these slight violations, they sometimes even if they, you are charged with fine, it will be very little amount, 100, 200 and so on.
Army spokesman Major General Lul Rai Kwang denies soldiers take money from border drivers.
First time I'm hearing, because our servicemen have not been dealing with borders. I've been seeing police loading on the truck motorbike. I never came across South Sudan people, they don't force them getting involved in that. And of course, this problem is going to be shared with the relevant authority, especially our commander for military police.
South Sudan in Focus reached out to a number of traffic police officers. All of them declined to comment. Abraham Jok, chairperson of the South Sudan Border Association, was said to be out of office. Jok did not respond to repeated requests to be interviewed for this story. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sereno in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, the U.S. is in talks with Sudan. Find out why after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how can you help young people discover their talents and develop them?
I think that can be done like from an early stage. Most of us right now are suffering and struggling with things because our parents didn't take the chance of getting to know our talents when we were very young. Because if a kid is young, you can easily tell what he or she is interested in.
I encourage you on how to develop your talent. If there is a need for money, and if I have, obviously I can give you.
What I can do is to inspire that young person to continue with that talent. And to develop them is to make sure that I continue working with that person.
Well, to me, I cannot help them in discovering, but whoever discovers himself, I can help in developing. And he has the will to develop.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Sudan government today welcomed a United States announcement that it will discuss dropping Sudan from its list of state sponsors of terrorism. The U.S. State Department yesterday said Washington is ready to begin the process of changing the designation if Sudan makes more reforms. The U.S. wants Sudan to cooperate on anti-terrorism activities to improve its human rights records and to work to resolve its internal conflicts. The Sudanese Foreign Ministry today said talks mark the start of the second phase of the strategic dialogue with the U.S. Some rights groups, however, urge the United States not to move too quickly, saying that Sudan's government continues to violate human rights. Although many countries in East Africa guarantee their citizens the right to justice, judges, lawyers, and government officials say a lack of education and funds is denying thousands of citizens justice every day. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Ruben Chama has more on the story for VOA.
Officials and legal experts say African nations need to improve access to justice through legal aid systems that tap both formal and informal systems. Justice Kihara Kariuki is Kenya's Attorney General.
What we are seeking to do is to bring affordability in terms of accessing justice to every Kenyan who finds himself or herself in a situation where they cannot access the courts. That may not necessarily be because of inadequate funding. A lot of us fear the courts, we fear the justice system because we do not understand it.
He says many citizens, particularly in the rural areas, cannot get appropriate legal representation in courts.
One of the things that access to justice and legal aid means is actually bringing that information to those who need to have it to be able to access it. Look at rural Kenya. What does the mwananchi in the far corners away from cities and towns know about how to access our courts? So we need to reach out to them and making them know how and what they need to do to be able to resolve some of their day-to-day needs.
Hundreds of lawyers, judges, government officials and activists from Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, Rwanda, Burundi and South Sudan are gathered this week in Nairobi. They are studying ways to integrate the informal justice systems with the formal justice systems. Nazima Malik, chairperson of the National Legal Aid Service, says women and children, as well as persons with disabilities, are the most likely to become trapped in legal systems they don't understand.
The vulnerable groups would fall into different categories. Obviously, those who cannot afford to hire an advocate. Those who have disabilities, persons with disabilities. We find women and children, especially children, being amongst the most vulnerable, which is why, as the National Legal Aid Service, we have an office in one of our offices specifically dedicated just to children's issues, children's custody issues, and children in conflict with the law issues.
Activists say up to 28,000 children are detained or treated unfairly in court systems across Africa. Many more, including migrants, refugee children, orphans, and victims of trafficking, are let down every day by a discriminatory and dysfunctional judicial system. Speakers at the forum say legal aid is an integral part of resolving disputes, particularly as regional integration among the East African states gathers momentum. Florence Ochago from Uganda is a principal legal officer for the East African Community Secretariat.
As ESC, we will support this effort to the best of our ability and hope that the aspect of legal aid shall feature prominently as a softer part of the integration agenda. Currently, we are speaking about the tough stuff, the common markets, the monetary union, the political federation. But as we go along with that, we need to think about the soft part of it as well. And I think that legal aid would be one of those things.
The four-day meeting is organized by the International Development Law Organization, an intergovernmental organization with a joint focus on the rule of law and development. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
The U.S. Congress recently passed the Bill Act, which could send U.S. financial assistance to Africa and innovate how the U.S. does business in Africa. As the landscape of business and development changes and the competition between China and the U.S. grows, a panel at the Center for Strategic and International Studies is looking at options the Trump administration has to help developing countries prosper. Ayen Dengbier has more from Washington.
The U.S. is reviewing its assistance programs to Africa as China cements itself as Africa's largest trading partner. Nilmini Rubin, a former senior staffer at the U.S. House Foreign Affairs Committee, says questions loom as the U.S. makes big legislative decisions about its financial aid for countries that need help with infrastructure, access to water, and electricity.
Every single president since World War II has reviewed foreign aid. So they've been looking at foreign aid before U.S. aid was even created. And so this is a kind of a natural thing, but every kind of generation, every administration is facing a different international context.
Early last month, Congress passed the BUILD Act, which stands for the Better Utilization of Investment Leading to Development. It created a new development agency called the U.S. International Development Finance Corporation, which has a $60 billion budget and is designed to support developing countries develop their markets. It allows the U.S. to provide loans and grants to developing countries around the world. The corporation comes into being at a time when China has positioned itself as Africa's largest trading partner. China has become the key international intermediary on important resources like the cobalt market in the Congo, according to Richard Bissell, a former director of the Bureau of Policy and Program Coordination at USAID.
If you watch the cobalt market in Katanga, in the Republic of the Congo, they've had a major problem recently, and so there's been a shutdown of one of the major cobalt mines. So it's not getting to China. It's Chinese-owned. Cobalt goes there. That's what goes into a lot of the new essential technologies like your Tesla. And so as a result, there's this reverberations going through the international system that's going to make it much more complicated for us to deal strategically.
Observers have argued that the BUILD Act is a direct response to rising Chinese influence on the continent. Bissell thinks the BUILD Act is timely and could help reposition the U.S. as the strongest trading partner with African countries.
I think the BUILD Act is one of the great developments, not for what it may be in itself, because we don't know what it will be. It's going to need to be fleshed out and deciding really what it's going to do and who's going to be part of it. But just the fact it was done is very important because we've been living with what I call a straitjacket of the Foreign Assistance Act since 1961.
China has come under criticism for what some have called predatory loan practices in Africa, as countries like Djibouti struggle to pay back loans to the Chinese. Sierra Leone canceled a Chinese loan worth more than $300 million in October, saying the loan would be uneconomical for them. U.S. officials have said Chinese practices lead to heavy dependency, while China's president says Chinese projects are aimed at building Africa and eliminating bottlenecks that hurt development. Ayen Dengbior, VOA News, Washington.
From Washington, we move to Kigali, where Rwandan journalists say the media industry is struggling financially. Some of the journalists say they never get paid and few work on contracts because private media outlets don't have the funds. The Rwandan Journalist Association is asking the government to increase the communication budget so public institutions can advertise. Eugene Uimana has details from Kigali.
Lene Lambert is one of Rwanda's senior journalists. He works for the private network radio and TV Isango Star. He says year after year, the financial struggle has gotten worse. Lambert says the poverty of Rwandan journalists persists, and it is deadly. Beyond the lack of salaries, the financial struggle means that some news organizations do not have the cash need to get journalists into the feed to report. Jerome Munyenhuari works at the Profile newspaper and is a former broadcast journalist.
I sent journalists for covering stories in the sub-country there, at the Western province. The one was just like an internship. He should be facilitated. Unfortunately, we had not money there. The guy has been hindered to go to the island that where I have been sending him. So the story, I have not got it. By the other side, that story was a key story in the edition that we should have that day.
There is a debate in the country about how to save the news media. Arthur Asimoe is the Director General of Rwandan Broadcasting Agency. He says on a wide view of the continent, Africans cannot tell African stories if there is no investment in the media.
For us to say we are telling the African story, you have to create a platform. And for it to create a platform where that story is supposed to be told, you need to invest in it. If you don't invest in it, it will be difficult.
Journalists say there is a lack of practical will to change the situation. Bernard Amata is the country manager of National Holdings Rwanda, which owns several local and regional news outlets. She says it takes a one quick fix to resolve this problem.
If we can have the taxpayer fund roads, fund water, health, why can't they do it for the media?
The news media are controlled by the Rwanda Governance Board, or RGB. The acting chief executive officer, Yusta Kaitesi, pledges to advocate for journalists.
It's true that there are many journalists who are not well paid, who have media houses that are struggling financially. We are able to present possible solutions. The journalists themselves told us that it's a possibility that if they create a savings scheme, we will engage with a lot of engagements with the practitioners, with the government, and with partners on how to really empower the media. But as I said, it starts with the media.
As of 2015, the governance board listed 116 news media outlets in the country, 23 radio stations, 11 TV stations, 48 newspapers, and 34 online websites. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now take you to Kampala with the song I Am In Love With A Stranger by Ragga Dee. Listening to Ragga Dee with the song In Love With A Stranger. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.